name's Megan Brantley. I'm the Vice President of Research at Likefolio. And this whole presentation is going to be about applying social data to trading and investment hypotheses. So this is just legal disclosure, but just about us. We analyze social media data to understand specifically what brands and products consumers are talking about, and also map these brands and products to these publicly traded companies. We're also listening for just overarching trends, and I'll kind of expand on this later in the presentation, but the key is to understand in real time what brands and products and what different behavior shifts are occurring and apply that to the market to take advantage of trading opportunities. This is an info. This is just something that we put out a little daily note about some of the social data, some of the insight that we're finding, if you're interested, but you can go to likefolio.com/drop, see that. And here is how we do what we do, because a lot of people, whenever we talk about social media, people can be a little bit hesitant. And so how this works is we are partners with Twitter. And so what this means is that we have full access to Twitter's database all the way back to 2012. And what this allows us to do is search not only in real time, but historically, how have consumers been talking about different brands and products? How has this changed over time? Are they talking about a brand or a product more than they were a year ago? And really fine tune the type of data that we're pulling out to make this massive trove of social media actually valuable and actually applicable to the world of finance. So this is an example of a case study about how we use Twitter data and how we've applied it in the past. And you can find this on Twitter's developer site if you're interested later, just for some background of application that I may not cover here on the presentation. But how we do this, how this all begins, is first we had to build out this big proprietary brand map, because whenever people talk about brands or companies, you know, they don't always explicitly say the parent owner of said company. So somebody might be talking about, for example, their iPad, but really they're talking about Apple. They may be talking about, in the instance of Nike, they may be talking about Converse shoes, but we know that Nike owns Converse. So it's really important that we understand all of the brands and products that could fall underneath the company's umbrella, so that when consumers are talking about the brand or product, we're able to map it and attribute it to the correct owner and the correct company. So this is just an example of some of the different brands that we have underneath Apple's umbrella. I think a lot of them, like the iPad, you know, that's pretty obvious, but some other things may not be as obvious. For example, the Measure app, or some of these Swell, Worklow, some of these more obscure brands that people could be talking about when they actually are talking about Apple. This gives an example of all the different keywords that we're listening to. So I think that part of what makes this data so powerful is we're not just listening for what people are supposed to say. You know, people don't always come out and say, oh, my Apple Watch, or oh, my iWatch, whenever they're talking about their Apple Watch. They may just say that they closed their three rings today. And we know that when they say things like that, they're talking about using an Apple Watch. So this really helps us to be intuitive and understand and capture a larger sample size when we're listening to what consumers are talking about. To give some scope to this data, we process and ingest between 3 and 5 million tweets a day. It's a huge amount of processing, and you know, we cover more than 300 companies. You can see all of these unique keywords that we have in this universe that we're listening for. And we also capture snapshots. So what that means is we know exactly when a brand or a product launches within a company. We know when a brand or a product changes hands from an ownership perspective. And this allows us to appropriately apply the data and the counts that we're reporting to the right ticker at any certain point in time. So this kind of helps us build a more accurate historical model whenever we're analyzing our data. And so, you know, I talked about that brand map, and that's really important because that's how we identify the products that people are talking about online. But we take it a step further. We have a couple of metrics that we track, one being purchase intent. So this means that we're listening for mentions that a consumer has actually spent money or plans to very shortly spend money in the near future. And we found that this purchase intent metric is really, really correlated with revenue. And so that's why it's so valuable. And this makes sense because it's talking about money spend, right? So whenever you count, are more people buying this product versus last year, you can kind of start to see the correlation there of how this could be really valuable, especially since we're processing this information in real time. We also track consumer happiness. And so what that is it's a breakdown of positive sentiment versus negative sentiment. So how, you know, what does happiness look like overall? Is it more positive? Is it more negative? How are consumers, how do they feel about their interaction with the brand? Are they happy with it? Are they upset with it? And most importantly, how is this changing over time? You know, a lot of times with sentiment. For example, you would expect sentiment for, let's say, an airline to be worse than perhaps the iPhone brand, because a lot of times whenever you hear of consumers engaging with an airline online, that's usually a negative experience and they're trying to work through something. And so that's kind of that difference in sentiment is to be expected. But when you see sentiment changing for a single company against itself over time, that's really indicative that something is happening and something is changing in the minds of consumers. And so that's where we find that really valuable. So these are the three main metrics that we're looking at. Overall brand volume, are more people talking about the iPhone this year than last year? Consumer happiness, are they happier? Are they less enthusiastic about the iPhone? And then purchase intent, are they tipping their hand? Are they talking about actually making a purchase, actually buying an iPhone, upgrading to an iPhone for this year versus last year? And those changes are where we extract the most value. We've also had our data studied by Georgetown University. And I think that what was really interesting, and this was not surprising for us because, I previously mentioned we always focus in on that purchase intent because of revenue, but Georgetown found that that our data aggregated at the firm level is predictive of the unexpected component of sales growth at the firm level. And so I think that that's really powerful. And I think that that shows, how you can actually harness social data in real time to help to inform your hypothesis and help to inform, maybe what you're seeing in your everyday life whenever you go to the store. If you hear friends talking about a brand, to say, okay, is this something that's just happening in my universe, or is this something that's happening on a massive scale? And without having to, I think that people used to do like store visits or parking lot visits to kind of gauge that. This is just kind of an example of the next generation of how to measure consumer reaction, response, and demand on a massive scale. I'll kind of give an example of something that happened. I guess it was last week. I think it was November 5th or November 4th, whenever U-Haul reported earnings. And I'll show you kind of what our data was saying and how we applied this and how we used this to inform a trading strategy. So this is this green line that you see. These are purchase intent mentions for the company U-Haul. So these are mentions of consumers who are actually talking about, renting a van, maybe buying moving equipment, renting a storage facility, somehow engaging or spending money with U-Haul. And you can see the red square that I've highlighted, the quarter that they're about to report, that second quarter. And a couple of notes, obviously there's significant quarter over quarter and year over year growth, but you can also see that this was the largest quarter that we'd ever reported on U-Haul's history since we've been tracking. And so this kind of really popped out to us because, whenever we talk about, previously we've talked about different, quote unquote winners or losers from the coronavirus and from these shifting behaviors. A lot of times you think of the Zoom videos and the Peloton, the Pinterest of the world, and those are absolutely overwhelming winners. But this was one that we were like, huh, what's going on here? Why is U-Haul popping right now, especially at this time? And it seems to be holding. Like you can see that far right, that shaded bar. I talk about we get these tweets in real time. So that was the trajectory moving forward after that initial second quarter had ended, but U-Haul hadn't reported yet. We could see that this momentum was maintaining. And we dug into it. What we like to do is we like to understand and look at things not just at the company level, but also understand what's going on overarching and for consumers. So how are, big picture trends shifting? You can see these are mentions of people who are talking about moving, whether they're, moving into or out of a new house, moving into or out of a new neighborhood. And I think these mentions increased, it was about 35% year over year in the month of October. And this is pretty significant. And you can see that, you can see right here, this is kind of an unseasonable bump, right? Like you see, obviously U-Haul has some seasonality to it based on when people are moving. They tend to move in the summertime, but this is much more pronounced versus the prior year. And so this kind of told us something. And you can see here at U-Haul, we have, it's a related company, and you can see this is the current trajectory, but you can start to kind of make sense of this and make sense of, okay, well, obviously it makes sense that people are getting U-Hauls if they're moving, if they're buying new houses, if they're looking for new houses, all of these things kind of line up. Whenever we actually looked at tweets themselves, we could see a lot of mentions of people had a lot more flexibility now with an extreme work from home movement. So I think that, U-Haul is an example of another company that's kind of a couple levels removed from quote unquote work from home. This isn't a Zoom, this isn't a Slack, this isn't a Microsoft Teams, but you can make the connection there and understand these different drivers that could be going on and contributing to this increased demand for U-Haul itself. And so this is the just general buzz and mentions. I talked about a couple of different metrics, and I wanted to be sure that I included this mentions chart as well, so you could see that it was also approaching all-time highs. eyes of looking at this. And so this is a screenshot from a sheet that we put out to some of our clients. And it essentially is highlighting what our earnings idea and positioning was heading into those second quarter earnings for U-Haul. And you can see that this earnings score, this is kind of a proprietary metric that we use based on buzz, demand, and happiness growth for a company, how we reward that. The fact that you see two up arrows, that's pretty significant. These are both green. And so this is a pretty strong signal too. You know, you would expect to see signals closer. I mean, anything plus or minus 10 is pretty neutral. And then as you expand, you know, as you get higher or lower than 10, it gets exponentially more bullish or bearish. So this was a pretty clear bullish call for us. And so we made a couple of trade recommendations, and based off of this data and based off of the underlying trend shifts that we were seeing in consumer behavior. And this is what U-Haul came out with in their earnings call. And you can see how that moving trend kind of connected in and helped to drive U-Haul's success. But you can see here that it was building. And whenever you talk about moving, July rev, it was up 11, 14, September up 24%. So we definitely saw this represented in our data. It's interesting to see U-Haul calling out these one-way rentals of people who are, you know, a lot of people who are moving out of cities into smaller towns. Now there's a little bit more flexibility. So this data all makes sense, and this hypothesis makes sense. And so this was just a really cool application in a time when we were able to see something that I don't think the market quite expected. I think actually whenever you look at it, U-Haul was actually trading down about 5% year to date. So this wasn't one of those, you know, prior COVID winners that had already surged ahead and it performed really well. I think it actually traded as high as 11% the next day, and it's still performing pretty well since they beat those revenue estimates and since they released those earnings. But the moral is that, you know, this helped us spot an opportunity, and especially looking at where U-Haul was going into earnings, we felt like we had a really solid bullish call here in place, and it worked out for us. So for the next part of the presentation, you know, I kind of talked about a use case, and these are just some names that we're watching right now. So I'll go through, you know, some of these that we expect to see or that we think have really strong potential to grow in 2021. First, I want to hit on, you know, I spoke in a similar event to this capacity in April, and these are the names that I spoke about. And I think that some people gave me a hard time for Pinterest on there, but ooh, that one ended up playing out really nicely, I think. And so these are, I think a lot of these names, Pinterest, Square, Roku, NVIDIA, Nike, these are still really strong names moving forward. I'm not certain that I would include Planet Fitness in that bucket, but I think that this is just a, you know, kind of showcase, to give an update to where we've been since the last time that I talked to a lot of you guys. So the first one on our list is PayPal. And it was interesting, I was on Twitter just before I came in here to give this presentation, and I saw that PayPal actually released their cryptocurrency platform to all users today. So this is very, very timely. And I think that this is really what's driving, and what we think is driving an opportunity for PayPal. So you can see this green line, these are purchase intent mentions of people using PayPal or one of the services. PayPal owns Venmo. So anytime somebody's talking about using Venmo or Venmoing their friend, so that peer-to-peer aspect. PayPal also owns Honey. I don't know if you guys have ever used Honey on your Chrome or on your browser extension. It basically automatically searches and scans and automatically applies coupon codes for you whenever you're checking out places. So it also has a lot of valuable data. I think that consumers like to be able to find deals. So that was an interesting acquisition for PayPal last year. But what you can see here, this green line, like I just said, these are people who are talking about using PayPal or using one of its services. And you can see this huge surge in March and then in summer. And this isn't really a surprise because we saw a huge shift in e-commerce during quarantine and COVID. And you can see PayPal shares benefited tremendously from that. And then we started to see things taper off and get back to normal. And so this would have been typically pretty concerning, especially considering how much the stock run in the meantime. But then we noticed this bump again. So you see this huge surge in demand at the end of September. And so we looked into, and we're like, what's happening here? What's going on to drive this demand? And it was the day that PayPal announced their cryptocurrency platform. And so essentially what PayPal's doing is they're not just allowing you to invest in PayPal, but they're allowing you to actually begin to make purchases they're not just allowing you to invest in crypto. They're allowing you to actually complete purchases with this. And so I think that this cleared some major hurdles for a lot of people, that A, it actually makes cryptocurrency tangible for, you know, usual retail purchases. They have a network of 26 million vendors. So I think that that's a huge potential opportunity. And also just interest in cryptocurrency in general is building tremendously. And so these are mentions of people who are talking about investing in a cryptocurrency. And obviously you can see the huge boom that we saw in 2018 that's captured here. So what we're recording now, while this is definitely, this is nowhere near the levels of activity that we saw in 2018, but it's still a significant increase year over year, up 50%. You can see that people are also talking about trading cryptocurrency up significantly, but I think that PayPal specifically knows its audience, and this is an opportunity for PayPal to expand their revenue streams. It's like I said, PayPal does know its audience. You can see that 14% of PayPal users already own some form of cryptocurrency versus 8% of non-PayPal users. So a PayPal user is already more inclined to be engaged with this. And they're already used to trying to use Bitcoin or trying to use cryptocurrency as actual currency in exchange for goods or services. So I think that PayPal kind of listened to where its consumers wanted it to be. And so that's something that we like to see whenever we're looking at a company like this. And I also want to highlight one of PayPal's competitors, which is Square, which you also saw on that summary chart of that was one that we were watching last year around this time that has been on a tremendous run and was honestly a first mover in this space. And so you can see this chart is mentions of people who are talking about investing on Cash App. And so using that Cash App, which Square owns, which is also a peer-to-peer payment form that's similar to Venmo. And you can see that every time they rolled out some type of new investing feature, the usage increased dramatically. And another interesting thing for Cash App and Square is that they found that whenever consumers started to use more products, so instead of just using Cash App to split a bill at dinner, if you're using it to purchase stocks or things of that nature, you're more inclined to keep using it more. So it was almost like a synergistic effect of not only just how often people were using it, but how much money they were keeping as balance in that, which is how Square is helping to build its own revenue. And this could be a really positive. You can see the parallels of how this could also benefit PayPal as they start to expand their platform functionality. In general, this just shows you how profitable Square has been ever since it started to allow that purchase of Bitcoin on its platform. It's insane. So I think that, Square has already proven that the demand is there. And if PayPal can execute in a similar fashion, or, there's no reason to think that they shouldn't exceed this success rate that Square's already seen moving forward. Now, as I just mentioned, they just opened this up to all users today. So this may take a quarter or two to fully come to fruition where you're starting to see huge results from PayPal. But we definitely saw in that first chart that consumers really were responding to this. They were excited about this. They planned to use this. So this is why this is like the number one name, I think, on my watch list, but one that we're watching certainly as this platform unrolls to confirm consumer adoption and see how much it can drive that engagement on the consumer level. So the next one's kind of fun. It's DraftKings. This is one that reports, I believe, tomorrow before market, but it should be a fun one for sure. I know that this is a fun space. I think a lot of people are seeking out different forms of entertainment because we've kind of been limited in the last couple of months. So we're seeing people who are talking about sports betting is absolutely exploding. It's kind of wild. But you can see here, these are mentions of people who are talking about using DraftKings platform, its app and its suite of products. And you can see that we're approaching all-time highs. This especially ramped right here at the end of July is when live sports return, and you see an extreme acceleration. Obviously, this is a relatively new name to real trading, I guess I would say. But and so there's been a lot of volatility. So this is again probably a little bit more of a risky name, but it's one, at least from a consumer perspective, this is one that consumers are jumping on board and they're jumping on the platform. So what's interesting too is that you see that huge ramp up of growth, and really DraftKings has only scratched the surface in terms of where you can actually use their platform depending on what state you reside in. Three additional states just approved sports betting in this last election cycle. So I think that by the end of next year, half of the country has legal access, which is still just a fraction. So I think that shows the growth potential. I think 9 states offer DraftKings mobile sports product. This is actually more than any of the other names that we track. So it is a market leader in that respect in terms of, you know, e-commerce, but e-sports betting. But it certainly has room to grow, and it certainly has room to expand. And we're already seeing its adoption rate skyrocket. So this is that sports betting, like I was talking about. These are mentions of people who are talking about placing bets on sporting events, which you wouldn't think that, maybe you wouldn't think people would talk about that on Twitter, but you would be shocked at what people will talk about on Twitter. And you can really see a resurgence every time a different, you know, professional season would open up. There was a big peak on MLB opening day. I think that the Yankees game set records for them. They noted that on their last report, and we're definitely seeing increased adoption and, you know, maintained adoption heading into, I think that this is as of yesterday. So I think that this is something that people are turning to, and that they increasingly will turn to as a form of entertainment, not only just as they're legally allowed to, but as entertainment options kind of wane. That being said, you can see just how important having live sports is. You can see there's a lull here in March and April, May and June, whenever there just wasn't as much going on. I think people still found things to bet on. I believe that DraftKings referenced some like table tennis tournament or something like that that people were betting on. But obviously this is sports driven. So I know, you know, if we start to see things, this would be one of those instances where if things start shutting back down, if live sports aren't able to be played, that could have, you know, negative ramifications for DraftKings. I know me personally, my college, my alma mater is not unable to play football this weekend. So not pleased about that. I think a lot of people are in a similar boat. So that's definitely something to watch. I would say that's something to be aware of for sure. But long term, the overall theme and the overall trend is definitely trending positively. More and more people are betting on sports, and access is definitely opening up in that manner. So these are some of the partnerships that DraftKings has. I think that ESPN was a big one. We saw the market respond really positively when they announced that partnership. You've got one, especially with the Masters just beginning, Bryson DeChambeau. You'll have to apologize if that's not exactly how you say his name, but I'm not certain that he's having quite the hole-in-one. I think it was him got the hole-in-one. I digress. But I'm not certain how he's performing now, but this was an interesting partnership in the first of its kind in golf, at least for DraftKings. And you can see how they're trying to leverage their media and their platform alongside these different players, these different brands, these different teams, just to increase exposure. And so far in our data, this is really working well for them. So then, like I said, this is sometimes whenever things look like a Pac-Man like this, a lot of times that present a divergence opportunity in our data. So an opportunity when we think that our data is suggesting something that the market just has not caught up to yet. So tomorrow will certainly be an interesting day. We'll see how DraftKings reports, but we're certainly expecting, according to our data, is supporting a strong report from them. So Roku, this is another favorite name. I think it was on the last watch list, and honestly, I'm not sure that the market really fully appreciates it yet. So it's on our list again. And what you can see here, these are purchase intent mentions of people who are purchasing a Roku or getting a Roku device or using a Roku device. And it does lean a little bit more to the device side of Roku. I say that just because Roku has two main streams of revenue. You've got your platform revenue, and then you've got your player revenue, your device revenue. And honestly, the platform, so that ad, that subscription revenue, is definitely more important for Roku, but it's still important to note, you know, what that growth is, what that expansion is. Are they still bringing new people to the table? And so you can see that growth has definitely slowed down a bit. But the key here is these are mentions of people who are talking about actually streaming on a Roku device. And this is really important because you see continued acceleration even after this quarantine period, right? You see more and more people who are talking about streaming on their Roku devices. And this is a really positive indicator if you're trying to ascertain how that platform revenue, so how that ad revenue may perform. Because obviously, if more eyeballs are on the screen and if more people are using this device to stream, then advertisers want to get in front of those eyeballs. And so whenever you're showing growth, you're showing more and more people, you have a more captive audience, advertisers may be more inclined to place advertisements on your platform. Roku also has a really interesting ad buying mechanism. Just as some background, they previously acquired DataXu, which is similar to a Trade Desk. I don't know if you guys follow the Trade Desk, but it is essentially a much more streamlined platform that allows these marketers and advertisers to place targeted ads on these devices. So before, that was one of the biggest hurdles that advertisers had to leap over in order to reach streaming audience, because it was really easy and there were tons of systems in place to purchase ads on cable networks and things of that nature, but it wasn't as streamlined. It wasn't as programmatic or systematic. It wasn't as easy. It just hadn't been built up yet for streaming. And so Roku's done a really good job of creating a platform for marketers. And that's kind of unrelated, but on the actual user side, where our data is concerned, they're continuing to grow at their share of streaming. They're the dominant streamer that we track whenever you're looking at them versus Amazon Fire TV versus Chromecast versus other forms, even smart TVs. And so this is kind of that dominance, like I talked about. They're, from a volume perspective, they're ahead of the rest. They're second in growth behind smart TVs. But one thing is interesting about the smart TVs is that Roku claims to have 1 in 3 smart TVs is powered by Roku. So even though a consumer may not know that they're using Roku on the back end of their smart TV, it's still that Roku software that's powering their streaming activities, and Roku still gets a piece of that advertising pie. I made a note about Apple TV because Apple TV is a little bit of an interesting one when it comes to comparison, at least in our data, simply because there are two things that consumers could be talking about when they're talking about an Apple TV. They could be talking about the device itself, so using an Apple TV to stream Netflix, or they could be talking about this new Apple TV subscription service that is like a Netflix, that they're watching Apple TV. So that makes it a little bit more difficult. So we kind of, that one is excluded from comparison in this instance, but just wanted to note that. But you can see that Roku accounts for a really significant portion of all the streaming mentions that we track, and this is continuing to grow. Roku is also expanding its own channel. So there is a Roku channel that is ad powered that actually contains content that you can watch. They just expanded this and added it onto the Fire TV, which is really interesting. I think that was a move that they've been trying to do for a while. So now, even if you don't have a Roku, if you're just watching that Roku channel and then thus being served at those ads, they still have a way to capture revenue in that manner. And you can see that this was explosive growth. People talking about, watching the Roku channel up 106% year over year. That's pretty significant. And you can see, obviously, there was a huge surge of people consuming content at the beginning of quarantine. But now this shift is continuing. This trajectory is continuing upwards. So this is definitely gives us reason to believe that Roku has plenty more room to grow. This just gives some background that, that platform revenue I talked about, that advertising revenue accounts for more than 2/3 of Roku's revenue. That's why it's more important than that first chart that I showed you that did show a slowing user growth. I wanted to kind of touch point on this, and the reason we really started following Roku, especially, as far back as 2018, even 2019, is because we knew how significant streaming was to how many consumers were cutting the cord, how many people were switching to streaming versus traditional cable versus this linear TV, and it only captured 3% of total advertising spend. Like, obviously, advertisers and marketers, like, these are not idiots. So they're going to get their content in front of where the eyeballs are. So we knew that this gap had to close, and we're starting to see Roku close that gap. And you can see, I think, another positive sign on their last report, they retained 97% of their advertisers that spent $1 million or more last year. So I think that shows that advertisers are seeing results and they're getting results from Roku. So as long as Roku keeps executing in that fashion, and as long as Roku keeps consumers happy, there's no reason to think that Roku can't continue to perform as it has. All right. So another fun one is Redfin. So Redfin is like a virtual, it's like a Zillow, I guess you could say, but it's all online in terms of like real estate marketplace. And what you can see here is obviously Redfin adoption took off upon, the onset of COVID. And it's waned a little bit, but I've highlighted this chart. This is the quarter that we're currently in, the quarter four. I think that we're a little over a month into this quarter. And you can see that the levels of people who are talking about using Redfin, whether it's to search a listing or to list their house or, whatever however they're incorporating it into their home buying or home selling journey, is up about 185% year over year. So this is still tremendous growth. I think that this shows a little bit of stickiness. So this is something that we're definitely watching moving forward. The housing market, I think, has boomed. Whenever you talk about new home sales and things of that nature, it somehow keeps feeding itself. But, we saw that a little bit whenever we talked talked about that case study in U-Haul of how, you know, people are moving homes. They needed U-Hauls to move home. And obviously they have to find these new homes somehow or get rid of their old homes somehow. So I think that Redfin is a classic beneficiary of this. These are some examples that show, you know, Redfin on our end has extremely high consumer happiness levels. And the main thing that people talk about is just how easy it is. So if you're a Redfin, if you're somebody who's trying to promote a digital platform that may not be as traditionally accepted in the real estate world, that's what you want to hear. You want to hear that your platform is easy to use. And you can see that this one person said that Redfin's more addicted than any social media platform. I thought that was just kind of funny to throw in there, but it does show the general consensus and the, you know, the drivers of sentiment of people who are talking about using this platform. And, you know, to go back to what trends are driving this, you can see these are mentions of people who are looking for a home, looking to buy a new house, but, you know, maybe it's not just home, you know, they could be looking for a new apartment, they could be looking for a new condo, but they're looking for a new dwelling. And you can see that these mentions, these are still elevated year over year, right? These are still really high. And so, you know, as we go, this is one that will be really important to watch, you know, through winter and through spring as things start to get warm again. And, you know, you start to see that little bit of a seasonal tick in here at the start of the new year. We'll definitely be watching for that. But so far that trend trajectory is trending up, and the shift to e-commerce and the value to be able to just do things online. We think that Redfin is really, really well positioned in that sense. Another interesting thing driving this is that location flexibility I kind of touched on for U-Haul, is that a lot of people now have the ability to work from home. A lot of people are permanently working from home. That means that maybe they can now live somewhere that they thought that they previously couldn't because they had to make it into the office every day. Or maybe it's even for somebody who, you know, maybe they're not moving cities, but now that they're working from home all the time, they need somewhere that actually has a home office, or that, you know, they want to just upgrade the space that they're in or to change the space they're in. And so you can see these working from home mentions are still significantly elevated. And this is a huge sample size. And if you're looking at how many mentions this is, but almost, you know, over 500,000 mentions, that's no joke. So this is definitely one that we're watching play out. These are some trends that we've got our eye on as people kind of get settled and reshuffle a bit in the meantime. Last quarter, this was one of Redfin's biggest struggles that they admit, that they didn't have the team built out as they needed in order to meet the demand that they were seeing. And so they've been recruiting employees and partners as agents significantly through the end of October. So that's always something that you want to hear if you're trying to find a company that might be a potential long-term winner. You know, you want to hear people who are growing their team and building because of demand is so high. So this is definitely going to be a fun one to watch and move forward. And the last one, this is my favorite one, especially going into the holiday season. This is the one that from a real-time tracking really got my eye on the closest. This is Etsy. And you know, I think a lot of people, if you haven't used Etsy, you're like, what is this? This is just a place where people are selling crafts or things of that nature. But we saw Etsy's platform absolutely take off in the last two quarters. And this rate that they're maintaining right now, this raid bar that you're seeing, is really significant. Still up almost 90% year over year. And this is heading into a really, really critical holiday season. You know, we're starting to watch, I think it's a really interesting opportunity for them because we're starting to see things shut back down. You know, we're seeing virus cases rise again. We're seeing restrictions being put back in place. We're seeing, you know, maybe people might be more timid to go into a store, go in to complete a purchase. And especially, you know, for Christmas, a lot of people want some type of a personalized gift. So it's interesting. We see a lot of that driving Etsy's purchase intent mentions and Etsy's consumer demand because of that personalized nature, because people are typically pretty pleased with their experience with other vendors on the site. The sentiment is really high. And so, you know, you're inclined to see a lot of repeat buyers that, you know, a lot of people might talk about the first thing that they find on Etsy, but maybe not the next thing after that. So that's why sentiment is really important to track and monitor to make sure that consumers are still happy. And so far, you know, that's something that we expect to see. We'll definitely be watching into, you know, as we approach Black Friday and Cyber Monday and people really get in the midst of all of this holiday shopping. This is one that I expect to see some spikes in, especially leading up through Christmas. But I guess the consumers will tell us whether they're using this or whether they're going somewhere else. But this is just one of those names that I think has, you know, has sold off a bit from previous highs that we saw going into its last earnings that honestly still could show extreme potential and extreme success in the current quarter that we're watching unfold. So these are mentions of people who are actually completing purchases online, and you can see just how significant this is. This is something that I think, you know, if you were to expand this and go all the way back to 2012, you kind of see this slow year over year build every year. And obviously these humps that you see are typically around Christmas time, things of that nature, people who are shopping online or completing purchases that. But obviously this is a huge, huge shift that was driven by the coronavirus and by people who are staying in and having to, you know, make purchases online. And you can see, you know, we track these different related companies, and there are a lot of companies that may be e-commerce related. And you can see Etsy's number two on this list right here of in terms of year over year purchase intent of how closely this could be helping to drive its own demand. So this is, you know, this is kind of the case for Etsy, if you will, and some of the trends that are helping to propel it. I talked about that personalization before too, but what's interesting is you still see a discovery element that Etsy brings to the table. I like to use Costco as an example whenever I talk about Etsy, because somebody once said, you know, if you're walking through Costco, a lot of the aisles aren't labeled because they want you to wander around and explore and look at things and hopefully find something else. There's like a whole discoverability element aside from what you just came and what you were looking for. And internally at Lightfolio, we always talked about, man, if somebody can recreate that discoverability and that searchability online, that would be a winner, right? That would be really, really powerful to be able to kind of recreate that in the e-commerce platform. And we're seeing Etsy do that really well. You know, we see Pinterest do it really well, and we see Etsy being very similar in that nature of consumers, you know, searching to find these things and actually being able to find these items that they're looking for, discovering a new brand, discovering a whole new type of product. And you can see just the steep acceleration heading into this holiday season. So this is definitely one that we're watching really closely that I think it'll be important to monitor, that it hasn't necessarily, I don't think proven itself yet this holiday season, but we still have a lot of time left now on Christmas to see how consumers react and how they respond. And they seem to definitely be trending in this manner, and this could really be a big winner this year. Yeah, so I think that there could be some opportunities with Etsy just because they've had such explosive growth the last two quarters that, you know, shares may pull back a little bit if expectations are a little bit too high, and those might be some excellent entry points for investors who like this name long-term. This is definitely one that we like more and more long-term. So we're watching for opportunities like that. But you can see that new and reactivated buyers grew 112% year over year last quarter. That's really impressive. And so we'll see if those people make repeat purchases this year. Time will tell. So this is, you know, in summary, the five of the names that we're watching really closely over the next year that we think that are already positioned well and have pre-positioned themselves like ahead of where the market was already shifting. So I think that could help to propel them to significant growth, but definitely from a consumer perspective, all of these names look really healthy right now. So with that, that's all I've got for today, but I'm happy to answer any questions if you guys have any. I see somebody pointed out the divergence between purchase intent and DraftKings, and I agree. It's a really powerful opportunity, I think. So we'll see. We'll know tomorrow.
And I'll go ahead and mention too that I think the daily newsletter is really interesting. I'm subscribed myself, and I make sure to I watch for it every day around
3 o'clock.
I got today's issue right when you started. So
yes.
a lot of good info in there. So definitely recommend everyone check that out.
Yeah, thank you guys. This is always fun.
Yeah, thanks for being here. Great presentation.
Of course.